Welcome to the home of the conservative revolution. This is your weekly dose of common sense.
Hello, everybody. Corey Bernardi here. Welcome to another weekly dose of common sense podcast. The voiceover guy and I are enjoying a bit of a break over the Christmas New Year period, but we don't want you to be starved of the common sense message. So we've put together a highlights package. And so every Wednesday, you'll be getting your weekly dose of common sense podcast featuring some of the coverage that we've highlighted over the last year. It's been great to have you as part of the Common Sense community over the last year. Next year is going to be bigger and better and more important than ever. And so we'll be back in the week of the 14th of January with more Common Sense updates, because you're going to get more Common Sense in 30 minutes of this podcast than a whole year of their ABC. Enjoy the highlights. Stay safe in the new year, and I look forward to catching up with you in 2019.
In an age of deals, excuses and shortcuts, it's time for a better way. Australia could really do with a new brand of politics. Someone that will say what they mean and mean what they say. A party that will never quit, never give up. And I know Corey Bernardi and his team of Conservatives will always fight for you. They will fight for affordable and reliable electricity. They will fight for stronger borders. And they will stand up to political correctness and defend our Australian values. Australia together. The Australian Conservatives can bring conviction back to Canberra.
Authorised by C. Bernardi for the Australian Conservatives, Adelaide.
Are the PC nut jobs getting to you? Don't panic. This is your weekly dose of common sense.
It's fascinating to me, the royal family. I support the constitutional monarchy. I think the arrangements we have in our constitution is absolutely valid. But I'm incredulous, quite frankly, at the dignity that Her Majesty the Queen and members of the royal family have conducted themselves with through highs and lows, thick and thin. And one of the things I read about the royal family the other day is that they have what's termed the Marmite strategy. Now, Marmite, to those of you who don't know, is the British equivalent of Vegemite. And the Marmite strategy is one where no one detects or perceives that the product is changing, but there are incremental changes. There's a slight change in the label, there's a slight change in the recipe, there's a slight change in the jar. And the royal family is embracing the Marmite strategy to evolve from one of the most revered institutions, but slowly modernizing itself. And we saw an element of that in the royal wedding. It was almost inconceivable to imagine you'd have this gospel preacher and a gospel choir, that a prince would marry a Hollywood starlet or a movie star that was biracial, that had been married before. These things were kind of inconceivable to many people, and yet the royal family has carried this off with aplomb. Now, how it works out, we're never going to know. We know there's been some less than savoury characters, I guess, that have got into the royal family, but the institution itself seems to hang on, and I think it is increasingly actually revered by a great many people around the world. And that's because there's a sense of permanence to it. There's a sense of pageantry. There's a sense of fantasy, I think, for many people. And they're above the day-to-day cut and thrust of politics, of maybe our lives that we have. And I just have a tremendous respect for Her Majesty the Queen and the dignity with which she's carried herself off. And I guess it's also relevant that this week is the birth of Queen Victoria, the second longest-serving British monarch. She was born on the 24th of May in 1819. She reigned for nearly 64 years. Now, that's only surpassed by our current queen. And she led what is now known as the Victorian Age. She was the very first English monarch to give her name to a period of time whilst still living. And that age was known for its strong moral standards. It had rapid scientific and technological advances. For example, they developed steamships and coal-fired power and electrified trains and photography, the telegraph, and they had major medical breakthroughs. It resulted in a rise in prosperity and population and saw Britain become an imperial and maritime superpower. Essentially, during the Victorian era, Britain ruled half the world. She was known as a person of formidable strength and impeccable character, and she shaped what it was to be English, to be an English lady, and in ipso facto, what it meant to be an English gentleman as well. She was also famous for the saying, and it's now going into legion, where when someone made an inappropriate joke in her presence, she used to say, "We are not amused," or "One is not amused." Now, since her passing, cultural Marxists are working hard, very, very hard, to unravel the morality, the confidence, the pride, the cohesiveness and prosperity that Western societies inherited from Queen Victoria's significant reign and legacy. I, for one, want to preserve it. I for one, think that there are some things worth maintaining. And, you know, the morality, the pride, the cohesiveness, the prosperity and the dignity that has been shown by Queen Victoria and her successor in Queen Elizabeth II, and I hope by succeeding generations of the royal family, will hold Western civilization together as we face enormous challenges. Now, I'm a supporter of the royal family. Many of the listeners out there I know will be Republicans and say Australia should stand on its own two feet. Well, we do. It doesn't detract from the fact that, you know, the royal family has played a pivotal role in global history, in our nation's history, and I'm going to be mindful of that. Let me know what you think. Corey at coreybernardi.com. We can have a further chat about it next week.
Do you think you've got what it takes? Become a member. Be part of the conservative revolution at conservatives.org.au.
Our children are unwitting participants in a dangerous social experiment. Their minds and their identities are part of an indoctrination program that threatens the very foundational values of our society. It's happening in our schools, it's happening in our councils, our state and federal governments, and every single parent should be worried. In fact, they should be very worried. Now, most people would be aware of the federally funded Safe Schools program. Now, the founder of Safe Schools confessed that it was a Marxist indoctrination disguised as an anti-bullying program. I need to remind you that it encouraged preteen children to think about being in a same-sex relationship. It referred them to sexually deviant websites and told them that they, rather than biology, actually determined if they were male or female. Now, I belled the cat many years ago, as did some of my colleagues in the parliament, and our concerns were dismissed as lies, either by those that were behind these programs or those too dumb to know what they were actually talking about. Eventually, the federal government funding was stopped, but the indoctrination hasn't. We've now got Victorian councils. They're removing books from libraries because they perpetuate the gender stereotyping that compromises the fiction of gender fluidity. Now, you may be familiar with the subversive theory that boys and girls are actually different. Yes, they're complementary, but they are certainly different. Well, apparently that's too dangerous to let continue. So it's time to burn some books. In South Australia, 12-year-olds are being asked by their school to complete surveys discussing their favourite sexual proclivities and the type of lube they should be using. I had a concerned father contact me this week about Lesbian Day at his child's school. Now, when he contacted the principal of the school, he said he was powerless to stop it because it was a student-led initiative. Imagine that, spontaneous uprising of Lesbian Day. In Queensland, children as young as 4 have been encouraged to undertake 2.5-hour group therapy sessions where government bureaucrats actually make audio recordings of these kids' thoughts on friends and family. Now, in true Big Brother fashion, if the bureaucrats become, and I quote, concerned about my safety because something I say during the workshops, then they will need to talk to people who can help me. Well, who is going to help us and save us from these Eastern Bloc family surveillance sessions that could unleash the very thought police to protect children from those dangerous heteronormative Christian or plain middle-class views that may be expressed around the house? This poison has happened in other Anglosphere countries, and it's now happening here. Time to say enough is enough. Unfortunately, the voices prepared to speak up are few and far between. These programs are dreamed up by radical social warriors. They are funded and fostered by governments, and they're foisted on children with parents blissfully unaware. And the damage has already been felt. Too many of our current generation are less resilient. They're less equipped to cope with adult life than ever before. They have this sense of entitlement, this delusion and self-absorption that has been fostered by these foolish social experiments, and it's only going to create even greater problems in the future. It's time we did something about it. We have to raise our collective voice to put a stop to this madness.
Do you believe in civil society? Become part of the conservative revolution at conservatives.org.au.
Listeners, you'll know that I've written 5 books, including one of which I'm most proud, called The Conservative Revolution. It was published in 2013. I've read you extracts from it before, but I want to share with you the opening chapter, if I can, or part of the opening chapter, because I think it captures where we are today. Here it goes. I've never considered myself a revolutionary. Revolution has always been seen as the preserve of the political left, whose commitment to change is led by loathing of the status quo, rootlessness, and the desire to seek change for change's sake. Even the term revolutionary and its noun revolution are inextricably linked in the minds of most of us with leftist guerrillas like Ernesto Che Guevara, an apparently charismatic mass murderer and leading figure of the Cuban Revolution, whose image has ironically become a pop cultural fashion statement, a sales and marketing exercise for capitalist T-shirt manufacturers. But it is time for a revolution in this country, a revolution that will restore the principles and values that have successfully guided mankind and our society since the dawn of time. We need to restore that which is now routinely ignored in the blind pursuit of new agendas that are remarkable, not for their lack of substance, but because they are built on the economic and moral corpses of previous failure. We need to reacquaint our citizens with the understanding that there are absolute truths that hold true in all places and at all times. We need to make a radical departure from the growing and all-pervasive acceptance that critical and discerning moral judgment is somehow unfair and an infringement on human rights. We need to re-establish the notion that taking responsibility for consequences is just as important as freedom of choice. We need to reaffirm that the family is the most important building block in any society, and that the well-being of children is the best investment that any society can make. We need to recognise that our nation has a role to play in international affairs, but her primary responsibility is to her citizens. In short, we need not just any revolution. We need a conservative revolution, one that will re-establish the family, the social and economic virtues that have been neglected for at least 2 generations, yet are as innate within the human spirit today as they ever have been. That's the conservative revolution. And I'm Corey Bernardi.
This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
It's time for your say, and what a bumper crop of emails I got, literally hundreds of them. So please understand that if I can't get to yours, it's not because I haven't read them or haven't seen them, it's because time simply doesn't allow it. But you know, a lot of people continue to come back to the same thing. I get this from Alan. I used to enjoy your weekly column when it was in a simple print form. What you have now makes me not bother to read it, so there is one less potential supporter you have lost. It seems like big government and big business, you have fallen into the trap of being over-sophisticated for some of your readers. You know, the problem is, Alan, that the people who are complaining about my weekly email that goes out simply haven't even read it, because the only thing they're asked to do is to click a link to get to read the weekly column themselves. If they want to listen to the podcast, they click another link. If they want some news on the Australian Conservatives, they click another link. It's not that hard. I just don't understand why people complain about something they haven't even read. So, Alan, if you're not listening to this, that's okay. But for those that are listening to it, please read the email. Click the link. It's not that hard. And if you don't want to receive it, delete it. Unsubscribe. Owen wrote to me, and he said that On this day in 1988, this is something he's quoting me, I referred to Queen Elizabeth II, Queen of Australia and head of the Commonwealth. This is in my podcast and my weekly blog recently. Owen says, Her Royal Highness Queen Elizabeth II is not Queen of Australia. That is a legal fiction created by Gough Whitlam in 1973 when he corporatised Australia. Well, actually, Queen Elizabeth is the Queen of Australia, just like she's the Queen of many other Commonwealth countries. And I support the constitutional monarchy, and I'll continue to do so, particularly after the royal wedding this weekend. Robert writes to me, Smaller government is a policy of the Australian Conservatives. Would you please direct me to any material explaining how this might be achieved? Robert, please go to the Australian Conservatives website. There is a comprehensive policy platform there. There is about 10 years worth of written archives about my thoughts on government and ways in which you can make it more efficient. Some of the simple ways we could do it would be to eliminate the replication of the bureaucracy. Why is it that the states are responsible for, say, education, and yet we have this massive federal Department of Education? Why is it that the states are responsible for hospitals, but we still have this massive health department? There is ample opportunity to save tens of billions of dollars every single year by cutting out unnecessary programs, removing duplication, consolidating a whole bunch, or eliminating even a whole bunch of these, you know, quasi non-government boards and special advisory councils, you know, reduce the reliance on consultants, freeze the pay of politicians and public servants until they can actually get the budget back into the black and start paying off the debt that we're accumulating for our children to repay. Now, Lynn has written to me, I'm outraged that Sydney University is allowed to teach Sharia law in this country. This is in reference to a newspaper article about that left-leaning Sydney University. What can we do about this? Can you speak about this against this practice in Parliament? Now, this is an issue that I've been talking about for a very long time, that Sharia law or Islamic law is not compatible with Australia's culture or way of life. It is not comparable with our existing sets of customs and legal laws. Now, when I was with the government and we were then in opposition, the Labor Party actually were looking at, and they released a brochure and held a function about establishing Sharia-compliant finance in this country. And when I raised that, of course, they dismissed it, said it wasn't true. I then produced their brochure, and I went through it and said, by your own admission, this would entail, you know, redefining treaties, redefining a whole range of our corporate laws, our insolvency laws, the expectations about our banking laws, effectively be establishing two sets of principles attached to finance acquisition in this country to satisfy a very, very tiny subsection of the community. And in the meantime, you'll be dividing the rest of Australia. Now, they abandoned that, but I tell you, the Liberals were zero help in it. They were absolutely no help whatsoever. In fact, some of my regular critics in the then party room came out and just said I was being alarmist because they don't acquaint themselves with the facts. They are emotional reactionaries rather than people that are building on facts and substance. And it's easy to score a cheap headline by playing the ban rather than playing the substance of it. But you're quite right. I don't think our universities should be teaching Sharia law. I don't think our government should be embracing it or empowering it in any way, shape or form in this country. But they don't have the courage to stand in the way of it. We need people of courage, and that's why we need more conservatives in Parliament, quite frankly. John's written to me, given the blatant rip-offs being perpetrated on ageing Australians by the so-called retirement villages, I think much more emphasis by government should be placed on providing in-home care for our ageing citizens. I agree with you. You know, if we can encourage people to stay in their homes and equip them to do so in a cost-effective and efficient manner, not only will those people be more comfortable and better off, the community will be better off because then aged care facilities will be there for those truly in need, and it will help stop the blatant rip-offs as you describe them. And one of the things that I think we should think about is what they do in some other countries is allow personal carers to be brought in, like au pairs for, you know, for our children or nannies. But, you know, you may need a personal carer, someone who can live in your home, accept room and board and a more affordable wage structure to work in a full-time capacity than, you know, having someone pop in and out and having to maintain their own residence as well. Not a perfect fit, but I think it may be something that we should consider. Now, Paul's written to me in respect to my opposition to the banning of cash being used for anything over $10,000. And Paul runs a cash transit security service. But he says the introduction of cash limits at businesses can take amount being amounts of $10,000 being banned from July 1, 2019 will affect his core business immensely. I thought AUSTRAC was put in place for this very reason. Paul, your personal circumstances are you will still be able to transport cash. Businesses will still be able to transport cash. It's just you cannot use cash to pay for a one-off transaction in excess of $10,000. So if you're a pub and you take $100,000 a day, no one's going to be buying something for $10,000 or more. You just have, 20,000 people giving you smaller amounts of cash. So your business should remain intact. That shouldn't be a problem. And I understand the principle of what the government is trying to do, because it is largely people involved in nefarious or criminal enterprises that want to pay for things over $10,000. But it's not exclusively. And my principle is, if you've got a currency, it should be legal tender for all debts, for the purchase of all products that are legal in a particular country, whether it's $5,000, $9,000, or $90,000. I don't think the government has any right to ban cash. I don't think they have any justification really for it, aside from their creeping desire to have only electronic currency so that they can claim the taxes from it. Helen writes to me, "Dear Senator Bernardi, my nephew shared a meeting to Facebook at the Trade Hall in Melbourne where they were celebrating Karl Marx. Of course, Karl Marx's birthday was recently. One of the speakers is that Ros Ward," and that's how I describe it too, "that Ros Ward, woman slash man, indoctrinating children in schools without their parents' permission." Yeah, good on you, Helen. I can't believe we've got groups of people celebrating the birthday of Karl Marx. Another dud. Another dangerous dud, but unfortunately his ideology is experiencing some resurgence. And of course, why aren't we surprised when we've got Ros Ward? Again, when I identified Ros Ward's attack on capitalism, which she justified through the Safe Schools program, remember that awful program which is just poisoning the minds of our children on gender theory, that this person was dangerous and to be reckoned with. And of course, the usual suspects in the party room said, "No, it's just Bernardi being alarmist," but I was right. Thanks for that, Helen. Felix, "I was always a Labor voter, but this time around I'm not sure. I haven't made up my mind yet. I admire your conviction when you left the Liberal Party because you felt it was not running the way it was supposed to run. Can I ask what is your stance on Muslim immigration? What is your stance on Sharia law? Should we slow down immigration?" Right, my stance on Sharia law is straightforward. Got no business in this country. Should immigration be slowed down? Yes, it should. Our immediate policy for the Australian Conservatives is to halve it because it's not acting in our economic, our social and our cultural interest. Where I'm going to disappoint you, Felix, is that I don't believe a blanket ban on any brand of immigration, be it race, ethnicity or origin, can be sustained in a credible manner. There are good people of all faiths, all belief structures, all creeds and all colours in this country. We want the best and brightest of them to come to Australia because we need immigration. It builds us, it makes us stronger. We just need less of it and we need a better targeted immigration policy. We also need to make sure that the rorts and the scams in our visa policy are abolished because people come here as students just as a way of getting a job and then applying for permanent residency. They get 4, 5, 7 visas and then spend a couple of years here as a shortcut to getting permanent residency. They apply to come to Australia, they get permanent residency, and then they discover they've got a whole bunch of family that they can reunite with at our expense. And then we find out that there are visa-granting programs in certain countries where the whole thing has been rigged and scammed, that those most in need are somehow prohibited from getting it because, you know, the people who are assessing their application or the front line of application processes don't want to see them get it. You know, Egypt was a case in point with this, where the Muslim Brotherhood were involved. And if you're a Copt trying to flee persecution in Egypt, you'd never get past the first application. We've got to fix that. And so there are high-risk countries where we need to take the processing of all visa applications onshore. We need to be very, very circumspect and careful about who we allow into our country, lest we undermine our way of life, our cultural norms, our social mores, and the very future that we want to make for our children.
Like what you hear? Support the Australian Conservatives at conservatives.org.au.
Do you remember Al Gore? He was the Vice President of the United States who ran against George W. Bush and lost in the infamous hanging Chad election, where a few votes in Florida determined the leader of the free world. Well, Al Gore was clearly disappointed. He was a disciple of Bill Clinton, but he dusted himself off, much like Clinton did, and went out and made a fortune producing a mockumentary, a junk science video, which was released on the 24th of May in 2006. It was called An Inconvenient Truth, and it painted an apocalyptic version of the future because man was apparently changing the climate through the emissions of carbon dioxide. Now, carbon dioxide is that gas that we all exhale. So basically, every time we breathe, apparently we're destroying the planet. It was a shameless film of junk science, but it propelled Gore into a climate evangelist. It made him hundreds of millions of dollars. He's got a lavish mansion, properties, he's got planes, and he's got a carbon footprint the size of a small city. But apparently that's okay because he's doing good. Now, Gore's hypothesis was that man's carbon dioxide emissions are dangerously heating the globe. And it was one of these hypotheses that the goalposts continued to move. It was global warming, and then it became climate change, and it became this and that and the other. And the predictions changed so often that no one can really call this scientific. Now, since the film's release, this hypothesis has taken more hits, and yet still people are convinced, they're brainwashed into thinking, you know, man is destroying planet Earth by heating the atmosphere. Now, I know there are many scientists that rely on grants from governments and others, but there are too many people in government that believe this hoo-ha as well. Now, the centerpiece of Gore's Inconvenient Truth video was the hockey stick graph. It's been utterly discredited. We had the emails of what was termed Climategate, and that exposed massive manipulation and collusion by once trusted scientists, institutions, and their peer review process. All of it painted a picture that we were being gamed so that the radicals could get more control of our economy, the scientists could get more cash, and government could insert themselves at the center of everything. Do you remember how they talked about carbon dioxide was driving temperature? Well, polar ice cores clearly show that concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere lag temperature, and it lags it by centuries. And global average temperatures have risen very, very little, notwithstanding the fact that Al Gore continues to say that we've only got 3 or 4 or 5 years before it's going to be irreversible. He's been saying that for 10 or 15 years now, and most of his predictions haven't come to pass. Global average temperatures have risen so little, nowhere near what the climate models predict, that the climate models can only be wrong. Global sea ice is not melted away as predicted. Polar bear numbers are actually growing. They're not declining. And in fact, they're becoming quite a pest in some Eskimo communities. Now, you go to satellite pictures. It shows that the continents are greening. They're not browning. The deserts are shrinking. They're not growing. And over 80% of Pacific islands have been found to have actually grown in surface area or maintained their size. And this is notwithstanding the fact that these Pacific island leaders often go and claim hundreds of millions of dollars or ask for it to mitigate the effects of this climate change. What about hurricanes? Well, hurricane numbers and strength have not increased, despite what Al Gore told us. And in fact, they've fallen by 25% since the last cyclical peak in 2005, 2006. And thermometer-based records, of course, have been identified as being compromised because they're chock full of what they call a urban heat island effect, where a surface-based temperature thermometer record was there. It's now surrounded by concrete and buildings, and so naturally the heat island effect drives up that. But when you compare it with nearly 40 years of satellite records of global temperatures, which are unaffected by this urban heat island effect and other man-made effects, they continually show significantly less warming than the surface temperature records that are relied on by the alarmists. Now, unfortunately, this poison has been promulgated through our school system, it's been promulgated by the media, and it's been absorbed by the political class. And they continue to implement damaging policies that don't do anything for the environment, but they make our cost of living prohibitive. They put government at the center of everything. They make the rent seekers reliant, even more reliant, on taxpayer funding. And if you want any evidence of that, have a look at the electricity industry in Australia. Climate change policy, global warming policy, this renewable energy policy is costing us billions of dollars and putting the household electricity bill up by a pile every single quarter. It's time to call it out. There's some inconvenient truths about one of the great scams of our time.
Keep listening. This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
That's all we've got time for this week. Thanks so much for tuning in. Keep your feedback coming by sending an email to corey@coreybernardi.com and tell your friends and family that this is where you can get your weekly dose of common sense.
This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.